Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, and this case, no question about it, Dr. Gabor Maté, the author of a best-selling, New York Times best-selling book called The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. And welcome, Dr. Maté. Let me just say, I feel I know you. I have never met you. But I spent the last three nights with your mistress, this book, and I just said, close the chapter about an hour ago. And I didn't realize it's 500 pages. Now, I'm saying that not to turn people away, because it's a page-turner. It's brilliantly written. I don't know if that's the result of your son, Daniel, who will work with you or you. So I don't want people to be frightened of the pages, but I do feel this obligation to actually read to the end of a book before interviewing someone. And I've been doing it for 3 days now, and it's fascinating. I would say it's the indispensable book if you want to know where we are, not only our own culture, but where we are in the world culture. And I'm making a very big claim for the book. Not that there are any really great answers in it, by the way. You very honestly, at the end of the book, say you're not particularly good at that. You will give us some therapy about how we can cope with it and improve and not lie to ourselves. But I don't want to lay out the big thesis, but what I found fascinating about it is that it basically described our illness. You really discount the role of genetics. I don't want to get in trouble with your colleagues, but you know, pre-existing conditions, DNA structure and et cetera. There's a lot of science in the book, and that's your specialty. But what you do is you set it in an international context of an alienating culture, and I think that's an incredible contribution. That these are not our individual ailments. They are national. They are international. So why don't I turn it over to you to sort of tell me, you know, what the book's about. And I do want to raise one question. I mentioned before it's a best-selling book. It was on the New York Times bestseller list, I think, for about 7 weeks. But I was trying to think, there's somebody you kind of put down a little bit, Dr. Benjamin Spock, who I actually knew. I'm older than you, about 10 years older. And this is the first time I've actually seen some criticism of this baby doctor's book. And I think it rang true to me, even though I raised children on the basis of it. But I would contrast it with it. Dr. Spock basically said, it's in our hands. We can make it all better. And you actually end up saying, no, the culture is toxic. And we have to recognize that and then do our best to be honest and cope with it and try to change it. Is that a fair summary?
Well, first of all, you're quite right. This book was my mistress as well, and it took all my time and broke my heart many times. So, it worked like a mistress in a certain sense. I did write it with my son, and it took the literary skills of both of us to bring it to completion. In terms of Dr. Spock, I first became aware of him much around the same time I first became aware of you in the late 60s, early 70s, around the anti-Vietnam protests. And your magazine, Ramparts, was just a rampart in that struggle. Spock, at that time, I had a lot of great respect for as a brave individual, you know, who really stood up for principle. However, his child-raising principles were toxic. In some ways. So, for example, he taught parents not to pick up their kids at night when they were crying, but to leave them alone. Now, that's toxic to the child. So Spock, you know, great man as he was in many ways, he had some things horribly backwards. And if you look at what's happening in society today, we can look upon the illness that we see, the overdoses, the rising tide of overdoses, of suicides, of mental health conditions, of autoimmune diseases, as individual problems, as sort of genetic misfortune which scientifically is complete nonsense, or we can see them as manifestations of a culture that itself is toxic, that the way it treats people, the way it induces people to treat each other, the way it teaches parents to ignore the child's needs, which is unfortunately was part of Spock's legacy. It actually toxifies people. We end up developing not in accordance with our true nature, but we end up developing in a way that's designed to make us fit into an exploitative, consumerist, inequality-ridden, materialistic culture. And that's very far from our needs and our nature as human beings. So yeah, I'm saying that illness is not a manifestation of personal misfortune. For the most part, it's a manifestation of a culture. If you're of color, if you're a minority, if you're an indigenous person, you're much more likely to be sick, not because of any genetics, but because of all kinds of social factors and emotional factors that has to do with racism and inequality, for example. And so if it's in our hands, that's not an individualistic sense. It's in our hands as a society, as a community, as a culture. And unless we deal with the larger issues that beset society, we're going to miss the source of our pathology. Now, it's not that in the book I don't provide healing solutions. What you're referring to very accurately is in the last chapter, I say, I can't provide a formula for healing society. That's a much bigger question than any individual. And for that, we need communal input. But what we do need to do is to lose our illusions. And we have to recognize that this culture, what may be considered the norm in this culture, is neither natural or healthy. And we have to solve the problem on a communal basis. I hope that sums it up.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sum up the book. There's a lot more to the book, but I think it's a good introduction. And what I found so powerful in this book is, yes, it makes demands on us as individuals. That's a good criticism of Dr. Spock, you know, don't let the baby cry. The baby has no consciousness. You introduce us to the vulnerability of the fetus and then the child, something as a parent of three that I never really fully considered before. What's going on in this, and so already in reading the book, I think, yes, yeah, so it doesn't take away our individual responsibility to learn, to think, to be sensitive, but it is very liberating in making it clear this is not because we were born with the wrong genes or something, or that we screwed up individually, but it's a very big charge. And I happen to think, you know, I was thinking, why is this book not forever on the bestseller list? You know, it's one reason why I wanted to do this podcast. I, you know, from what I had read when I contacted you, I thought, wow, this is really a very powerful book. I thought, but then I realized when I got through about half of it, it was going to be a very, very big success as a self-help book, as a parenting book. But when you turned your vision on, wait a minute, is our general society healthy or unhealthy? When you put Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on the same shelf, in a way, not that they have the same politics or, you know, but that they're driven by the same kind of unhealthy forces, dare one say, you got into very provocative area here. And I'd like to pick up what was buzzing in my head as I was reading your book. I covered Bill Clinton's welfare reform, so-called welfare reform. Mm-hmm. I interviewed him when he was still governor of Arkansas for the LA Times, where I worked. And then I interviewed him after he's president and so forth. I examined the program down there. And everything I read about in the first half of your book was an example of what was done with welfare reform was exactly incorrect. It took the most vulnerable population, 70% of people on aid to families dependent children were children. It punished the mothers who, you know, were trying to do their best. It said we can end it. He told me personally, Bill Clinton, when I interviewed him, you'd have to spend a lot more money. You'd have to provide more. They didn't do any of that. I'd like to begin with that because this book attacks the conceits of liberals as well as conservatives. and it attacks a notion of individualism. So why don't we use that as sort of a case study, which I dare say is not featured prominently in your book, but the book really allowed me to understand it better.
Well, so the reason, one of the reasons the book was only 8 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list, which by the way is not a bad thing, is not had a stitch of coverage in the mainstream media. I mean, I've not had a single interview or mention or review in any major newspaper or television program or even the big NPR programs. And I think there's a reason for that, because I'm challenging the premises of the whole system. And I'm saying that, I quote Ralph Nader at some point, who said that the two parties are basically one clown with two heads, you know, that look different. So I'm not saying there are no policy differences between the two major parties in the U.S., but fundamentally they both serve the same system. And Clinton's legal reforms, for example, ended up sending hundreds of thousands of black men to jail, you know, and his welfare reforms devastated a lot of really poor people. And Clinton, for all his liberal rhetoric and his progressive and somewhat attractive image, really was swept along by the same neoliberal wind that began under Reagan and Thatcher. And that's been going on for 40, 50 years now. And the result is increasing loneliness in this society, which itself is a risk factor, increasing obesity, which is a risk factor for health, increasing isolation, breakdown of communities, the hollowing out of the American industrial heartland, the jailing of millions of black people, and the rising tide of suicides, what Clinton himself has called deaths of despair. Well, these don't come out of nowhere. They come out of social conditions. And Clinton's neoliberal policies did much to entrench those conditions. And you know, we do have to look at it systemically. Like, give you an example. One study that I quote, that the more experience of racism a black woman experiences in the U.S., the greater her risk for asthma. So, the lungs being inflamed has a lot to do with emotional stress, because you can't separate the mind from the body. But then the question becomes, is that woman's inflammation in the lung and constriction of her airways a sign of individual pathology in an isolated organ, or is it a social malaise? Well, clearly you can't separate the two. So the reason I bring in politics and political trauma and inequality and who controls the society into a book about health is because it's all one thing. It's inseparable. And Rudolf Virchow, a great German physician in the 19th century, he said once that politics is only the continuation of medicine on a larger scale.
You know, a big theme in your book, you kind of resurrect, I wouldn't attribute it only to Karl Marx, but he certainly made it front and center in relation to labor and production, the notion of alienation. And it's because the U.S. model is in effect becoming the worldwide model. I mean, China may be led by a communist party, but Apple loves it. Now maybe they'll switch to Arizona for some, you know, chips and so forth. They love it because they have a docile workforce. And the docile workforce, you quote Eric Fromm, you refer to Huxley seduction throughout your book. And, you know, it's the same gimmickry of the consumer culture, the same alienation that you have in China right now, which is causing discontent. I teach at the University of Southern California. We have 6,000 students from China. It's quite a focus group. And you know, these are people who are successful. And, you know, somebody was able even to help them go there. But they're feeling that alienation in China. Yes, we make this great technology. We have new consumer goods. We don't have what we had in the old village. Mm-hmm. Because after all, if you look at China back to Confucius, there was a notion of society. Mm-hmm. So what is Confucius' wisdom? You know, even the emperor has to be worried about social cohesion. You know, that after all was one of the promises, presumably, of Maoism at some point. That's all gone with China's version of neoliberalism. You know, and what you're basically saying is it's not a sustainable model there any more than it is here, because its key ingredient is alienating people from any mechanism of security, right? A sense to their lives. So why don't you, I thought that was a very bold assertion of your book, and we don't teach it. And I want to add something else about teaching. I mean, I wish this book will come out in an affordable, although textbooks are very expensive anyway. I'd love to assign class, you know, just have, in fact, I will. I think I'll assign it anyway, even though it's a little more money, because really you open up all of these questions.
Isn't it, $27 in the U.S.? Is that a lot of money?
Okay, that's not compared to a textbook. I think I will make it a text. Okay, yeah. Let me have a day to think about it. But seriously, I mean, I am being serious. We can't consider, look, right here where I teach at USC, we surrounded by a homeless population.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. You know, 70, 80,000 people out there on the streets right around us. The students get alienated from them. They're threatening. Who are they? Some of them could have been your neighbors just a few months ago. You know, we also have daily crime reports. Most of the time, it's a black or brown person. Who are they? Where did they come from? Yeah. Why are they stealing a cell phone? The second time they do that, they'll be put away for 5 years. Who are they? So alienation, as far as I can see, is a defining word for our time. And it explains Donald Trump, as you point out in your book.
Yeah.
You know, when I say the book is essential reading, I think if you're going to read one book about our time, it's this one. I really believe that, because you're a brilliant doctor, physician. You've handled tens of thousands of patients, a lot of mental problems as well as others. And you put it in a context that does not dismiss the science or the individual, but it tells them why you have a refrain throughout the book, why they are not the cause. I forget what you have, the way you put it in the book.
Yeah.
But it's empowering. So,
it's not your fault, you know. Well, Marx's concept of alienation, I mean, who could argue with the truth of what he said? That under capitalism, we become alienated from ourselves, from our fellow human beings, from our work, and from nature. I mean, just look at the impacts of alienation from nature in terms of what we're doing to nature today. Look at the impact of alienation from work. Now, if you look at what stresses people physiologically, psychologically, and physiologically, because psychology cannot be divorced, separated from physiology, they're really one dynamic, is what causes stress for people is uncertainty, lack of information, loss of control, and conflict. And that characterizes materialistic society, those four features. Elon Musk can, with a flick of a finger, throw 7,500 people out of work overnight. There was an article in the British Guardian about an American in southern United States furniture factory where 2,500 people were fired while they were sleeping. When they woke up in the morning, they got a text saying, don't come to work. So the uncertainty, the loss of control, you know, the fear, this stresses people emotionally. Therefore, it stresses their immune systems, their hormonal apparatus, their nervous system. And in terms of what you said about China, I quote an American social scientist, Morris Berman, who said that if the 20th century was the American century, then the 21st century will be the Americanized century. And basically, the American system has been globalized, whether it's governed by a communist elite, so-called communist elite in a country like China. It is the materialistic, competitive, alienated culture. And we can see some of the impacts of that in China today. Addictions are going up. Mental health conditions are going up. More kids are being diagnosed with ADHD. It's a crisis in China. Obesity has reached epidemic proportion in China as well. And as we saw with these recent COVID protests, I think you're referring to them without naming them in the last week or two, people are starting to push back. They don't like this culture that they're living in. So globalized neoliberalistic culture has been exported to the rest of the world, and it's creating a worldwide crisis. And as a result, health is suffering internationally. It's systemic and it's globalized. And we do have to understand.
Further in the book, you say it's untenable. It's inconsistent with really the human experience.
Yes.
And then you put it in the context of global climate change, of unemployment, insecurity, and you dare to make an assertion, which after all was what the New Deal under Franklin Delano Roosevelt was all about, which is societies have only one excuse for existence, which is to support people.
Yeah.
Support, whether they're families, tribes, or what have you. And they lose that, as Confucius kept warning, and as Aristotle warned, Alexander and others, they lose that. They lose their reason for being, but they'll also have instability, chaos, be overthrown. And we're seeing a lot of chaos in what you and I, you're 75, I think, now?
78, thank you very much.
78, well, then I'm only 8 years. Well, how old am I? I'm 86. But I grew up in the Depression. You grew up in Hungary. The Nazis first, and then, Soviets. You've had much greater trauma in your early life. But I dare say, I can't speak for you, but I think people of our generation expected society to be a lot more stable now, and a lot more. I mean, when I came out, I was a young kid, Roosevelt said we were guaranteed all kinds of things, decent health care, good public schools, a good benefits for workers, strong labor unions, which is another way of preserving society. Now, the very idea of organizing at the new Tesla plant in Arizona will be treated as suspect. Arizona might even pass a law saying you can't do it. Yeah. I mean, what happened to, well, let me take it back to you because one of the wonderful things about this book, you don't spare yourself.
No.
You ruthlessly examine that there were times you were not a good parent, that you failed in your response. We all should feel that way. We all should recognize that. But you've had a hell of a life. And before I let you go, the book, when I said, I slept with your mistress, the book is a great life story, as well as a work of political caution. It should be read really as a novel, based on this interesting character, you. So start with the mother who has you at a time when she has to give you away to save your life.
You're reminding me of the first paragraph of David Copperfield, where he says, whether or not I'll be the hero of these pages or not, only time will tell, look, as far as the world, let's be realistic about it. The Roosevelt interlude of relatively liberal and socially minded capitalism was a brief interlude in the history of capitalism. Capitalism began with the ruthless exploitation and genocide of indigenous people all around the world. And if you look at the history of the United States, the massacres of workers, the illegalization of workers' organizations, going back to the 20s and before, the union busting and all that. Then came the Depression, and the system was really under threat. And Roosevelt was bright enough to realize that to save the system, they had to institute some reforms. They did. But those reforms, where there was relative labor peace in the United States and relative benign social policies that would have characterized your youth or my childhood, that was a brief interlude in the history of this system. And when Reagan and Thatcher came along, the gloves came off again, and the system revealed its dark underbelly that had never actually been shed. It's just been covered up. And so since then, inequality has risen, the power of the corporations has risen, the direct influence, in fact, subservience of governments to corporations has become inescapable. So union busting and anti-union laws are again being brought in and practiced. The union system, the union movement has been largely decimated in the United States and largely in Canada as well. So those halcyon days that you look back to, I think was sort of a relatively brief interlude in the life of a world system that whose essential motives and slogans are always domination, power, and profit. And it continues to be that way. And that in turn has huge health effects on the bodies and minds of the population. And so my little story maybe helps illuminate some of that, as I suppose yours would. But there's a big story going on here that involves all of us. And the question is, do we recognize that it involves all of us, or do we continue to look at it as purely isolated individuals? That's really the issue I'm addressing in this book.
Yeah, so let me take issue with something you said. First of all, I don't mean to suggest, I was born in 1936. My father lost his job and my parents were garment workers. And, you know, life was very rough. And
yeah.
Not quite what you experienced in, you know, under Nazi occupation and then in the chaos and then fleeing Hungary after the Russian invasion, re-invasion,
yeah.
Assertion of power. I mean, you had, but you know, I didn't present them as halcyon days. I think it's important to discuss because they were an attempt, not just by capitalists. Obviously, Roosevelt was pushed by a trade union movement, the CIO, you know, workers' struggles, veteran strikes. But they knew something, and you have people, enlightened capitalists, in your book. You know, you have Warren Buffett, for instance, saying, yeah, there is a class struggle where we, the rich, are destroying the poor. He goes further than Marx. You got Stiglitz, who was in the Clinton administration, warning. We have plenty of enlightened, well, not plenty. We've got a number of even enlightened, wealthy people, which is what Roosevelt came out of.
Yeah, for sure.
My point was not that they were halcyon. Their point was, does the system have the capacity to save itself? And that is really the, when I got to the point in your book where with the very powerful midsection linking, I have to tell people, you will find this book very liberating. Not that it denies science, it embraces science, but it frees you from the tyranny that you have the wrong gene or you got the wrong ancestor or so forth. It frees you from a kind of arbitrary babble mostly of science. And in that sense, it's you have to then really examine what is the evidence. But when I got to your discussion of why our society is sick, which is after all, the big claim of this book is that our culture is abnormal. The reason I bring up the Roosevelt era, which what neoliberalism means is basically dismantling the wisdom of Roosevelt. Why? So I know this. I interviewed Ronald Reagan at great length in my journalistic career. His father worked for the New Deal. In his own autobiography, he says family would have starved if not for the New Deal. Roosevelt was a hero in Ronald Reagan's house. Bill Clinton told me exactly the same thing about, you know, coming from a poor background, what was done for them. So, you know, you'll even have people on Wall Street, the Lloyd Blankfein, whose father worked in the New York Post Office, telling you, yeah, we had good public schools. What I'm saying is that they've even given up that notion of reforming capitalism to save itself as
That's
a
right.
doctor, as a doctor giving a, you know, your analysis, the power of this book is to say, wait a minute, you're not taking care of the patient, which is the public, right? Isn't that the message of this book, that you can't just count on your therapist or that pill or that diet to bring you, you know, happiness here, right? Isn't that your message?
Well, you have the beautiful art of posing a million questions in five or six sentences. And so the question you raised earlier about can the system reform itself? Well, I think theoretically, yes. But it's at a certain point in its decline, almost every system comes to a kind of sclerotic relationship to itself. And so you might say the French ruling class could have reformed itself prior to the revolution, but they didn't, you know, and the signs were coming for a long time. I mean, it's not that the French Revolution broke out just all of a sudden by accident. You know, it was a long time coming, and there were warning signs, and the philosophers were warning the ruling class about what was coming, and they didn't reform themselves. You might say the same thing about the Russian ruling class prior to the Russian Revolution. There was a revolution in 1905 in Russia. Did the ruling class pay attention and learn its lessons? No, they didn't. And so at a certain point, and I'm not a prognosticator, I'm not a futurist, so I don't know what's going to happen and when, but ultimately, I think in a system where people are so committed to power and profit, I don't know that they still have the capacity to reform the system in order to save itself. If that's the case, let them prove it. My concern is at this point to show people, this is how it's working, people. Don't look to the leaders who are entrenched and who are at the apex of the system. Don't look to them to solve the problem for you, because they are the problem, you know, and they create the system that they enforce and celebrate is the problem. So if you think it can be reformed, more power to you. Prove it to me. But at this point, let's get realistic about what's going on. And so you're quite right. In the last chapter, I'm more of a diagnostician than a surgeon, you know. It's up to the public. It's up to all of us to decide what to do with this information. But I do want people to get disillusioned in a very positive sense. I want people to lose their illusions. And that's why I quote James Baldwin, who said, in the last chapter, I quote Baldwin, he said two things that we have to remember. One is he said that not everything that's faced can be changed, but nothing that's not faced can be changed, he said. So we have to face the way it is. And he also said that in this country, words are used more to cover the sleeper than to wake them up. And in this book, I'm trying to use my words to wake people up. Really, that's the essence of it.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Let me pick a bone here with the last section, because before we run out of time, and that is, you do seem to embrace, this is where I think Marco Polo is a great guy, and you know, I've actually had Japanese food with him in Berkeley. But I think, you know, drugs, it's almost like I ended the book where I started out. You mentioned ramparts. I mean, you know, I was doing some psychedelics and peyote back then. I get to this end of this book, and that's what we got. We got, I'm gonna drop acid, or, I mean,
I didn't tell anybody to drop acid.
Well, no.
Look, Bob, listen, I had 8 chapters on healing, okay?
Yeah.
33 chapters in the book, 8 on healing. One of those is on the potential of psychedelics to help some people overcome mental health issues and addictions. That's all. I welcome that. I'm not a psychedelic evangelist. I don't think psychedelics are going to change the world or save the world. I'm just saying, amongst the many healing modalities, they're one that is worth considering.
I know. And
I'm saying.
Sorry, I wasn't. And I, by the way, I don't think Michael Pollan is saying these are going to save us. And I don't want to demean his work. I think it's quite brave that he did it. What I did feel at the end, and as I say, look, I got really engaged with this book in a very positive way, very positive.
And
I criticize a lot about, you know, I am also, I have grandchildren and children. I live a normal life, and it raises a lot of questions, as it did for you. You very honestly examine your own behavior. It forced me. I turned to my wife while I was reading it, quoting from your book and paragraphs that apply to my misbehavior as a human being, as a parent, and so forth. However, the reason I bring up the end of the book is that, in a way, you're still giving us your professional advice as a healer.
Yeah.
And I understand that. And I took that away. Yes, okay, it's worth the price of the book just to help Bob Scheer heal better, you know, and that's good. But really, my healing, particularly if I do care about the future of my grandchild or grandchildren, is how do we stop this run amok world culture now of consumerism, of you know, Huxley's, you know, officially condone escapism and drugs. I mean, we are in a dystopian, you know, I did one, you have Chomsky in your book. I did a couple of these podcasts with Chomsky. We talked about which dystopia are we facing? Is it Orwell or a Huxley? Let me kind of end with that for you. And is there an alternative to it?
Well, I think there is. And I think some very great people throughout history have offered those alternatives. The world didn't need my little voice to write them another formula, but I can think of some great people who've provided all kinds of alternatives. They're called the Buddha, they're called Jesus, they're called Karl Marx, they're called Eugene Debs, they're called all kinds of Martin Luther King, they're called all kinds of, you know, Nelson Mandela, they're called all kinds of names. So the world didn't need one more blueprint from me, because the world doesn't follow blueprints. My job is just to lay out, folks, here's how it is. This is what it looks like. This is how it functions. This is why it's working. Now let's look at some solutions together. The one little suggestion I do make that I think would be essential, if we introduce trauma awareness into the education of doctors and educators and legal people, if we become understand of the pain in this society that's driving so many people, that's the underlying dynamic and so much of our politics, let's just get realistic about what's driving so much pain, so much dysfunction. As far as social formulas, I could offer my own particular vision, but much greater people than I have offered theirs, and I didn't need to do that, you know?
No, and I want to end this on, I am so positive about this book. I'm even sorry that I...
No. Listen, let me interrupt you. I love the debate. I love this engagement. We don't have to agree on everything. In fact, I wouldn't expect us to, you know. What I love is how much you've wrestled with this book and how much you've engaged with it.
Hey, I'm on my vacation in Maui. Yeah. And I've done nothing but had your book in my hand. But let me say, I do want to end on a significant note. I think we do all have to survive. And we have to make the best of our circumstance. And trust me, I treated the book as a guide to healing myself, okay? Mm. Because, you know, as you point out, you can be raised in some of these families where we just have to save the world, forget about saving our own children, our wife, our spouse, or other things. So the book is a corrective on that. You know, healing yourself is important, and you have these chapters on that are very instructive. I should point out, you've done 4 major books. You're not some, you know, you're a major public intellectual in the world, and deservedly so. I only want to throw in that while we do that, and we have to do that because people we care about will be hurt if we don't do that, if we don't improve ourselves, if we don't raise children better. I mean, I'm reading your discussion of child raising. I feel great shame, frankly, because I was so busy like you were. I was running around doing the very interviews I'm talking about with famous politicians and running to Washington. And I checked back and my wife was a big editor at the Los Angeles Times. And where are the kids and how are they doing? Well, your work is a great corrective to the people who say, I'm saving the world. You can't save the world if you don't get yourself straight, if you don't challenge yourself, and you can't even be a positive force. So, you know, I'm not nitpicking anything about that thesis of the book. I want to be clear about that. However, as I walk out after I've had my session with you as my shrink, I walk out and I say to myself, but also, what am I going to do to fix the larger picture? Because the fact is, we are in deep trouble. That's what your book makes clear, that we are in such deep trouble that when we're talking about the vision of a Donald Trump maybe running the country or a Hillary Clinton with all of her cynicism and denial, including her husband's behavior, but everything else about her own upbringing and about reality, the book has a very important message that the big picture is also important. Critical.
Yeah. Listen,
maybe we could end on that. I just think if you could summarize it, because you've got here, I keep mentioning it's 500 pages. It could be three books, okay? But well, it's powerful. It's powerful, more powerful, put together. Well, because while we're dealing with our own individual family job situation, it's not going to make it easier reading your book to go work at Amazon plant somewhere, but it'll give somebody a perspective of how it fits in, and that is also necessary to healing. Maybe we could end on that if you kind of...
You summed up the intention of my book beautifully when you said, what are we going to do to fix the big picture? If people end the book with that question on their lips and in their minds, I'll have succeeded, because they have to get that the big picture is inseparable from the small individual picture. So if people can walk away from the book, really engage with the question, what are we going to do together to solve the big picture? I'll be very happy, and I'm very happy for your understanding of the book. So thank you very much.
Well, let me just say, I think you cannot read this book without walking away, which is why I don't want to be conspiratorial here, but I think it's a reason why this book is not getting those reviews, those puffy reviews in the mass media organizations, because it has an uncomfortable message. It's not all in your individual hands, even if you're super wealthy, even if you have the biggest toys, even if you have plenty of examples in your book of very successful people who are miserable. And if nothing else, they're visited with real medical, mental, and problems that you can't just wish away. So the book is, again, I want to end by saying this, essential reading. It just brings these different worlds together, the people going off on retreats, the healing, the cults, everything else, all of that searching for how to be a better person, how to improve, how to relate with what do we do about maybe that we're destroying the planet? Why do we have all these refugees? Why do we have so much violence, gun violence and everything? Why do we have the continuation of all these wars? This is, let me just say it clearly, the book to read if you want to understand your time. And it's not just in America. It's worldwide. It's a worldwide culture that is examined, and it is a culture that this book makes clear is untenable. It's anti-human, and it cannot continue in its current form. On that note, thank you, Dr. Mate. I want to thank Laura Kondrajian and Christopher Ho at KCRW, the very good NPR station in Santa Monica, for posting these. Joshua Shear, our producer. And I want to thank the JKW Foundation, in the memory of Gene Stein, a terrific writer, for providing some funding for this show. See you next week with another edition of Shear Intelligence.